Hi, this is Martin Fowler, and you're listening to The Agile Uprising.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm Andrew Leff. I am your host for this evening. And today I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Merman and Troy Lightfoot. And we are very pleased today to have Dean Leffingwell from Scaled Agile joining us to talk about all things Scaled Agile 5.0, whatever flavor we want to add to it. Very excited to talk to Dean again with the group. We had a great conversation when SAFe 4.5 came out, and I'm looking forward to talking about 5.0 as well as the current environment of all of our remote work. So welcome, Dean.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah. This is a really weird time. How's everything at Scaled Agile during the remote days? I know you all have had to crank out a lot of content and updates, and Probably you've been some hectic days, huh?
I suspect you saw that, being our partner, and how quickly we had to do a pivot. Now, interestingly enough, we'd had pressure for some time, I mean, at least a couple of years, for large enterprises saying, we can't get people together face-to-face, even for safer teams, it doesn't work that way, you know, develop remote training, and we've resisted that because there is simply no replacement for the osmosis and the team-building activity of face-to-face, so we're huge believers in face-to-face. At the same time, we had this challenge of scale, which is enterprises, and you've noted some of them, the kind of the preview of this podcast, is that sometimes it's 5,000-10,000 people, and they want to go hard and fast. Well, imagining, you know, face-to-face safer teams for 10,000 people, that doesn't really scale either. So for us, it was an accelerator. So it was less a diversion than it was going back to core, and core for us is developing great courseware that supports the framework. As you know, we don't monetize the framework. It's free. There's no paywall. There's no ads. There's no click here and get your favorite partner. So we depend on courseware for a living. And when face-to-face went away, well, a lot of our revenue went away. So we had to pivot and help our partners, folks like you, and we've got a lot of folks like you, A, enable you contractually, and B, give you the tools. And by the way, that's still a work in process. So we did what I would call phase one. We've got phase two in progress for this PI. We just finished our first totally virtual PI planning to further enable those courses. And phase three really is what we're kind of calling the digital classroom. How will this look down the road when 3,000 people need to learn safe together? So we've been in a scramble that happened to us mid-PI. We actually did not stop and replan. We maybe could have. We did essentially the same thing by working through our portfolio management function. So when we got to the end of the PI, some of the objectives were funky. And some people said, well, we've substituted the right ones, the ones we did. And my team just stuck to the originals because, you know, we're trying to, that's a predictability measure, not a measure of goodness or how hard you worked. So it was a little twisted that way. But the net effect was we did a pivot basically mid-PI. We came out of it, okay, we're a strong company. We're in no danger of an existential crisis here at all. So we feel good, but we feel good at lower revenue for sure. And I look forward to the time when I could be on stage at the summit and meet 200 people, you know, in 3 or 4 hours. And you know, we're tribal beings. So this is not my view of how we'll all work later, but it is my view of how a lot of us are going to work a lot of the time.
Yeah, it does feel like regardless of how we come back from this, things will be different, right?
So I agree.
It's good that you all are seeing that, right? And we don't have to get into the whole remote, virtualized coaching, launching, training thing, because that's messy in and of itself. But it is interesting to see, hey, how do you shift when you know things are going to be different moving forward? Because it will.
One of the things, you know, you previewed this a bit with SAFe 5.0, and I still have the pleasure of occasionally digging deep and developing real method work in the company. And I actually wrote the organizational agility article. It went through, I think, 17 revs with my team. And each time my feelings were a little bit hurt. But we got to, you know, kind of bullet number three there, which is strategy agility. And started talking about how it is that when you know what your way of working is, we know what our portfolio epics are. We know what's in the team's backlogs. We know what the commitment we had for the PI. When you know all that, the ability to make a change is not so difficult. because you can filter that through. And nobody's sitting there, you know, like automatically proliferating change backlog items, where we're working against a different portfolio, a different set of objectives for the PI, and everybody understood that. So we didn't stop and replan kind of physically at all, but or even virtually, but logically we kind of did. So the ability to have strategy agility, to know that you have a plan, it's relatively short term, to know that your work is connected. You know how work flows, you know how you determine how the work happens. You know what a thing is? You know, is an epic to remote enable our courseware? Well, you bet. That means, gosh, that requires portfolio involvement. It makes sure we need to understand the financial impact. What's the licensing model going to look like? So I was really pleased that strategy agility, which is third dimension of OA, we use that. And we use it kind of effectively to go, well, this is different. Chris gave a talk at All Hands kind of in the middle of, you know, kind of the, you know, there was a time at which some people weren't meeting and then all of a sudden everybody went home. Well, right in that cusp, we had a meeting, and we were still largely face to face at that time. And he pointed, we have the luck of a big physical portfolio and program board, and he pointed at it and said, "We know how to do work. We just need to change the work we need to do." And he said, "In my earlier careers, it wasn't always obvious exactly how work flowed or how you would change the work you were doing. You communicate, and communicate, but you couldn't see it." So our work is visualized. We know what the work is. We know what an epic is. We know what a feature is. We know what is acceptance criteria for having a court remotely enabled. So there's so much more we know now in Agile about the work physics that it's just a lot easier to change.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting conversation you're bringing up, Dean, and it's something that I know that I've struggled with, and I could probably, you know, my colleagues will probably be empathetic as well, in the sense of it's that planning, that cadence, that refinement activity of truly talking about the work before just executing, right? Like getting enough information and feeling it's just good enough, not perfect, but good enough. And that leads me into a question around when you talk about business value and when we are talking about and defining business value, I would love to hear how you bottom line business value. It's one of the abstract points that I find difficult to explain to a company that doesn't value business the way what they value today isn't where we'd like them to be. So getting them there, right, that edge that we have to cross, has been a challenge to define it in a way that is meeting the client where they are.
You know, and a little bit of history will probably inform that. So much of what we've done isn't obvious except via our history. So, you know, a decade or so ago, maybe a little more, I was doing this work with a few other folks and oftentimes by myself at big companies. And we would do, you know, face-to-face planning because that's what we do. I mean, there's a simple rule in SAFE that says the people that do the work plan the work. And by the way, that can be virtual, remote, it can be five locations and two locations, but the people that do the work plan the work. So we were evolving to that point, and I would leave an enterprise after a PI, and I'd come back at the end of the PI and say, "How did we do?" "Oh, really great. We got more done than before, and it seems like we had, you know, higher percentage of story completion." And it left me wondering, did we do what we needed to do, or did we do what we planned? So with Agile, you move away from, you know, long-range planning, but holy Toledo, as professionals, I'm sure you coach all companies all the time that say, "Look, for the next 60 days, can we have a solid idea what we're going to deliver?" So I invented that on the fly because I needed a simple metric that didn't require any tooling, because my company's tooled differently, that was lightweight and easy to assess was meaningful. So I just started having the business owners have a conversation with the teams during planning and saying, "If you had to rate these, which is more important from a business perspective?" And we got into discussions about enablers versus features and how you might have five business owners saying, "Well, I don't know why I want to move to 64-bit back office servers." And one architect is saying, "Because if you don't, we're not going to be able to trade a single security, you know, until hell freezes over." And so I just invented that off the cuff to say, just tell us on a relative scale what's more or less important, and we'll come back together and we'll establish how we did against that. And the reason was is that stuff happens, as you know, when you get into a PI. And as stuff happens, you need to know what's most important next. So I think a false notion in general about priorities, because this is priority number one. Well, what if I'm blocked? Why do I just get a pick? No, pick priority two. So that simple 1 to 10 was just literally off the cuff. We wrote it down on a couple teams. We came back and said, how did we do? And we said, we did really well. Now, somebody could jump on that and say, well, what is that? Just a weird number that gets set by business owners. There's no quantification of that, really. There's no physics behind it. And I asked the question, if you had to choose today between higher productivity and higher reliability, which would you pick? And they said, we can't improve productivity without reliability. So I said, this is simply a predictive measure about how good we are at determining what we're going to do in the next 60 or 90 days. And that demystified it. Everybody said, well, that kind of makes sense. And then the value, of course, is less in the number than the discussion. We went through our setting business value just, oh gosh, 2 or 3 days ago. And each time the development team would go, I didn't know that was so critical. And the business owner would go, I didn't realize we couldn't do this if we didn't do this other thing. So we're communicating about abstractions that get converted into lines of code that get compiled into a set of bits and get executed faithfully and reliably. So you have to have a lot of communication through that thread. And what's most important to the business is what are those communications? I mean, it's in a way, it's kind of business agility before we called it that.
Yeah.
Do your stakeholders agree that you're working on the right stuff? And when all else fails, what are you going to pivot to?
You know, it's funny. Like, I've had so many people ask me, well, we're prioritizing our features. Why do I need to, why are we doing a second prioritization? And I've always explained the business value number as we want teams to, you know, be connected to value at their level the same way that you all at the program level or the portfolio level, like whatever level you're at. And what you said is so powerful, Dean, about the conversation, because if you force them to have that conversation, who cares what the number is?
Exactly.
But if they have that conversation, you see value connected all the way from the top all the way down to the bottom.
And I'll tell you a secret
different
in our internal world. We start off really easy. We ask the teams, what are their commits, right? We're going to have the EMEA, the European trade show. It's going to be virtual, and it's going to happen first week in June. That's a commit. What's the priority? It's a 10. Then we look through and say, what are the rest of the commits? Because we're people of our words. And then we say, okay, what would you pick as the next most important one? And they'll go, we really think we need to do this. That's probably a 9. Except for, you know, kind of the uncommitted set, I don't think we ever get below 7 or 8. So the reality is it's a 4-point scale on a 10-point range, because nobody can ever say something's only a 2, because that means you're not going to do it. So it's really, you know, 6, 7, 8, or 9, or 10, and the 10s are commits, and then you work down from there. So once you get the hang of it, it's pretty fast, and the conversation is everything. And we'll be sitting there going, you know, 7 or 6, I'll go 6. And they say, why do you pick 6? Because that'll end the conversation. Okay.
I mean, it's interesting you started to, you know, reveal about business agility. So has that been a driving force in the changes to 5.0 as far as leaning into the business agility desire?
You know, what was the driving force was our SPCT and SBC community. So a year and a half ago, when we were incorporating, we were design thinking people, and we were incorporating that into SAFE. And as we were doing that and started writing those articles, now this is a year and a half now, I forget exactly. As we got familiar with design thinking, we started going back to kind of first principles. So we were going to our SPCT meeting in front of the Global Summit. It's a full day workshop. And we had on our whiteboard in our workroom our top 10 epics. And we looked at it and said, let's forget that for a second. And let's go in and run a workshop, and let's have the SPCTs and Luke Holman, who is master facilitator there, define using the epic value proposition, epic value statement, their view of our priorities. And we didn't even set them up to say, you work in this area, you work in this area. We set up 10 or so groups, and they all came back with their list. Then we compiled those lists and we merged them. We found 2 things that weren't really on our radar. They were coupled and they rose to the top. One was, in many of these enterprises, we've gone as far as we can with tech, and we have barriers with legal, We have business owners who are not in the Agile world that still want the commitment. We've got a CFO who rightfully demands ROI. We've got a group maybe operating with our portfolio management tool that's saying, great, we love agility. Please fill in the task for the rest of the year to justify your people that are working on, you know, to justify you have all the people. So we ended up with all those, you know, weird kind of constraints on the system. And what we were told by our SBCTs is we need to address that with business agility. Now, they didn't call it exactly that. I think they called it safer business. So I was honestly a little bit reluctant because, you know, we're engineers here. We're computer science people. And for me to think about, I have a lot of experience with business, and I'm going to opine, you know, on how you might think about running marketing was a big stretch. But the demand was clear. The second part of the demand was that as we work in these larger enterprises, they need to measure how we're doing. I've always been nervous about measuring Agile and measuring teams and measuring people because it's a double-edged sword every time. It cuts both ways. And they said, but we don't have any choice. We're making these investments. We're going to train 1,000 people. And we have to tell really, you know, what how we're doing on our journey. So then that kind of launched what we now call Measure and Grow. And we went live with that at 5.0, but I'll preview here. We're actually going to finish that 360 loop this next week and publish our Measure and Grow database. So that would say, okay, if we're not good at this area, what do? Read more articles? Try harder? Okay, come on. Take a course? I did, or maybe the right people didn't. So they ask us two things. We want you, Scaled Agile, to lead us down the path of business agility, number one. And number two, you got to help us tell our customers how they're doing. Neither of those were on our roadmap. So the number one and number two from our customer's perspective, and by the way, we went to the SBCTs, we went to the voice of the customer, and we went to the partner meeting. We had 250 partners in the room, and we all had them prioritize those epics, and that's what they came back with. So we didn't jump into business agility because I'm kind of a savant that says, oh, I'll bet everybody really wants their business to be agile. We jumped in it because our customers and partners said, this is what you need to do to help us next. So that wasn't cleverness, that was listening. And that's why that whole design thinking thread is so valuable in there, because you really stop and say, well, what does customer centricity look like? I come in with my 10 epics and have them prioritize. No. Why don't we have them tell us on a whiteboard what we should do, whether we're already thinking about it or not? Now, they missed some things that we think are really important, and I won't go into those details, and we've continued to evolve that. For example, you know, the whole area of DevSecOps is an ongoing development. So we added those back, but we stopped and listened first. So we were in the understanding. Now, another interesting story about that is there were 5 or 6 of the tables that said, we need safer business or business agility. So I took thought leaders from each table aside, and I said, what is it? How many definitions do you think I got?
150.
Exactly. Some tables had 2 definitions. So what I learned from that is it's really valuable. It's like agility with a small A. Everybody wants it, and nobody knows what it means. So then we went back to first principles and looked at our core competencies and say, honestly, none of these really address that. But from the standpoint of organizational agility, value streams and arts do if it's done right and you reorganize. And then the other thing, this whole lean agile management paradigm, it really kind of befuddles you. But what I think will occur is that the real management paradigm is continuous learning. It's not, you know, either servant leadership or command and control or agile thinking. It's continuous learning. We said without continuous learning, either for the implementation or for the company's success in the market. So again, continuous learning and OA were the things that we said, if we add those, and by the way, also enhance the leadership part and clean up a little bit, you know, we used the Scrum definition for team. There was a dev team and a Scrum owner, a Scrum master and a product owner. Well, if you're talking to a small team of marketers or you've got, you know, you're maybe doing some reprocess engineering. Well, those people don't think of themselves as developers. So we'd lightened that language a little bit. And just said, hey, they're agile teams, and they could be blended teams, mixed teams, cross-functional teams, or whatever. So it threaded through the entire framework as kind of a watermark that said we just step back a little bit, still support dev teams. This is still a software business for the most part, but we need to make sure that our peeps are comfortable. And we've been working on safer marketing and safer hardware teams and all the things that will add some more muscle to the promise of business agility. And we're also starting to see it. We saw it in this crisis. I just put up a case study today from a Brazilian media company, and they talked about how once they engaged their business, they achieved a different level of business agility. So the term starts to be out there. There's a Business Agility Institute, and we just kind of channeled on that and said, we have to do more than we did. But it wasn't that we were that clever. It was that we really listened well. Now, interesting enough, we did the same thing this year. And the answer this year was we need to get back to the stuff we didn't do last year. We moved business agility in first place. So we didn't end up with a big strategic pivot at all this year. It was, well, now we have one, of course, with COVID. But prior to that, it's like, would you please clean up all that other stuff you said you were going to do last time that got trumped by business agility?
So, Dean, this is great stuff. It's Troy here. I have a slight change of topic. I mean, safe related, but it's not around business agility, if you don't mind. And it has to do with some kind of basic tangible things at the art level. You know, one of the problems that we run into is, as coaches is, you know, management, leadership, they want to know what to measure. Right. And they, you know, there's a lot of metrics you can use. And one of the things that, you know, a lot of us try to distance themselves from is using velocity as a metric. And try to use it for more forecasting for the most part in capacity management. But one of the things that I'm into, and I think some of the other folks on this call are as well, is probabilistic forecasting. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts on probabilistic forecasting instead of story points in SAFE, and have you seen that before, and just general thoughts.
So if Luke was on this call, he'd talk to us for about a half an hour, and we'd have to get him to shut up after a while. On probabilistic forecasting, I will have to say that I feel like it's a good day when I can work with 100 or 150 people on an art, and they can say, I think in the next 60, 90 days we can do this, and I'm pretty sure the next thing after that is this one. Is there more science under probabilistic forecasting? I'm sure there is. Is there smarter ways to do it? But I'm this kind of pragmatic first principles guy. This is what the business objectives are. This is what the PI roadmap looks like for this PI. This is about as good as it gets. Now, a year from now, I could have a whole different answer, and Luke could have taught me all of this stuff, and we'd roll it in like participatory budgeting. We didn't have that 2 years ago either. But right now, I got to admit, I don't really understand it. It's one of those things that sounds great, but I wonder what the science is, and I don't know.
Okay. Well, I do have some experiences with it. Be happy to share at some point.
Maybe write up a blog post, and we'll link to it.
Okay, I'll do that. Sounds good.
I love giving Troy work. That's the thing. Like more work we can give Troy. That's
hey, with the framework team and the company in general, you got to be careful about what you suggest.
That's right. That's right. Troy has a million ideas, so he'll volunteer for it all.
All right. I'm sorry. I don't honestly feel like I have the domain knowledge and competency to really address that. But I'm confident there's more science than we have in SAFE right now. And if that science develops it, for sure, we'll figure out how to apply it.
I actually have one. This made me think of another question for you, Dean, real quick. And so I apologize for just kind of interjecting with it. But the idea of software development in SAFE, you know, what I actually love about SAFE is that on the picture, it has Scrum and XP together, right? Yep. And often when we walk into clients, that XP is always like completely left out, you know? And so I'm just curious as to your thoughts, whoever's listening to this, you know, if they're at working for a large enterprise, what is the criticality of not only doing Scrum, but combining Scrum and XP in your opinion?
Okay. So again, history, I learned XP first. And at the time I'd come from various environments where we were building, you know, provably safe systems. They called them, you know, man-rated systems at the time, you know, things that go bump in the night, anything from systems for warfighters to infusion pumps. So I was really, my entire career has been, well, most of it has just been focused on making software that actually works. My first 20 years was mostly medical equipment. So I learned XP first, and initially, because I was a high assurance guy, I watched Agile and saw the words about just work on the next most important thing. We don't need no stinking requirements. And I was able to just completely blow it off. And then I learned extreme programming. And I was sitting down with a developer programming, and we were pretending to pair programming, which meant that he was writing the code, and every 10 minutes he'd let me write a comment. Okay. And he wrote some code, and then he stopped and he wrote a bunch of other code. And I was just knowledgeable enough at the time to say, what's that? And he said, well, that's the test for the code. I said, well, don't you think your code will work? He said, no, I know it won't work, but it's my responsibility. I actually talked about this story. This story is my responsibility, and I'll be danged if I'm going to put this in the baseline when I don't know it works. That, for me, that was like huge. Holy cow. He personally took the responsibilities for saying that story was tested. Now, as I, if you go back, you know, 15 years or so, there was actually, you know, kind of XP Scrum Wars. Mm-hmm. And you saw people like Ron Jeffries, you know, big XP fans joining the Scrum community. Well, Scrum won because Scrum is, you know, easy to do in a lifetime to master. And it's just easier than writing unit tests and automating them. Well, as I was doing the transformations with Scaled Agile, I would do Scrum, some Scaled Agile, and then I would find consultants in the community that were XP experts and companies like, I don't remember the names of them now, but there was one in Michigan that was really good at it, and I would hire those people to come in to instill the basic Agile technical practices, which in my view is where Agile started. And then together we had it. Now, one of the least popular ideas I had is that I don't actually see it, Scrum and XP and Kanban. My team does all of those things. We have peer review and standards and definitions of done that are very XP-like. We have Kanban for flow. We always know where our work is. We recognize excess WIP. We run iterations. We run short ones. The team runs 2 weeks. My team runs 1 week because 2 weeks is just too long. Also, I can never remember which week it is. Week one or week two. So I've always seen this blend of saying, you know, time and half, you get to use Scrum because I'm a Scrum guy. Well, you should use XP because I'm an XP guy. Well, don't you understand Kanban, you idiot? And I'm going, you got to do all of that. Give me one Agile team in the year 2020 that doesn't have to understand their flow, have good, solid software engineering practices. And by the way, DevOps is a big part of that. I mean, I think XP started the DevOps movement. Continuous integration was belabored to death in XP before DevOps talked much about it. You got to do all of those things. And people look at that and they go, well, you blended a bunch of weird stuff and blah, 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 and you stole all these ideas. I don't care. I'm coaching teams to deliver the world's most important systems. And I'll be danged if we're not going to take every single tool, whether I don't care if it's story mapping or empathy maps or extreme programming or unit testing or DevOps. I don't give a hoot. This is what it takes to build systems of complexity in the year 2020. And we're going to provide everything we can. And the only limitation to that is there's only one 8.5 by 11 big picture.
You know what really emerges for me as you just walked us through that, Dean, is the word discipline, right? You have to be disciplined in your practice as an organization to even understand, to keep momentum moving. So I love that story in the sense of the discipline of not just being held back by a framework or being dogmatic about it. It's really understanding the voice of the system and what that is trying to emerge and tell you back and really creating the discipline to build the muscle. So thank you for sharing that.
I called that about 3 or 4 revs ago, Scrum XP Bond, but my team laughed me out of the room. So
that's why you're in charge, Dean, because you just say, no, this is happening.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, as chief methodologist, you gotta be careful, you know. Authority is a powerful drug, and you only want to use it when you need it. And if you use it more than is absolutely necessary, you're not doing your job. And if you think that because teams are empowered, that leaders don't have some management authority, both are, you know, you're wrong. You have to have both. So yeah. I can remember maybe once or twice in 5 years that I've told my team, I'm doing this because I think it's right. But I don't often have the courage, and I have such respect for my team that if they said, you know, Scrum XP Bond is stupid, I'm going to listen to that. I'm going to back off.
Sutherland said years ago, you know, probably around the same time that you started championing it, Sutherland has said that Scrum without XP is, you know, just process, right?
It is.
Process is not what delivers great software or great solutions, right? Business, you know, great process plus great technical practices.
Yep.
That's where it comes from.
We were, you know, for example, we're working right now with the marketing teams because Melissa is real keen on providing some help because she joined our company and she learned Agile and she's our VP of marketing. And we looked at that. We started looking at quality practices. We looked at peer review. Okay, so marketing should put out a press release. Hasn't been peer reviewed? No. We looked at definitions of done. If you do a campaign, do you get feedback from that? We looked at standards. What are the standards for a piece of work? And I forget the others. And we harvested 5 or 6 of those. And we said, that's what quality looks like for an Agile team. Now, are they doing TDD? No. Are they doing test automation? No. Are they integrating their DevOps pipeline? Actually, in some cases, they are. But those basic practices are really, as Demi said, those are universal. So we have to make sure that everybody understands you have to do them. And of course, that's a hit on safe. You have to do all this stuff. Well, guys, as I think you know, what do you think?
You do. All together, right? Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So we can either pretend there's an easier way or just say, you know what? Building that satellite, that's going to be really tricky. That next infusion bump, that next MRI system, that one of the companies that we worked with was doing a banking system that they were going to deploy basically the general case in 31 countries and then specialize it and then hope to wrap the specializations that evolved back into the general case over time with a couple thousand people. Well, you got to have some muscle for that, and you got to have a framework that scales to that purpose.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. So I'm switching from the bottom of the big picture close to near the top. So, I'm doing this for purely selfish reasons because I'm having to do this with my client right now. Lean portfolio management, right? So it is in my mind, one of the most complex parts of the framework. It has so many moving parts and nuance. And also the people that are going to be working that level, they actually have like titles and power.
They do.
And egos and
authority.
And they're way higher than me, and I'm just the consultant, right? That they hired to fix their teams, kind of a thing, right? So, for those that are reaching that kind of tipping point, what do you feel like I need to know going into this, like to be either worried about or wary of, or just really be focused on first when I'm trying to launch a portfolio management effort?
That's a fair question. And the reality is, I think there's two things that are precursors to being successful there. You have to understand the taxonomy, right? You can't advance science without knowing what a thing is. If they've never heard about a feature or an epic or a Kanban system, right, or a value stream, they're going to be completely lost. It's just gobbledygook. And we as techies, we get so invested in that taxonomy that it's like, well, of course, that would be an epic. Well, what the heck is that, right? That's one. And number two, the principles really do matter. You've all taught Leading Safe. You know that the first now 6 hours of that course is the principles. Why do we set this base design? Why do we not use the old milestones anymore? Why do we want fast feedback? Why do we want to apply the MVP thinking to our epics? If those two things are present, your executives, I mean, these are big boys and girls. They're not stupid people. I remember there was this theory, you remember, you know, maybe 30 years ago, the Peter principle. Everybody gets promoted to their area of incompetence. I've not found that to be the case. I remember when we were at Rational and we worked with IBM and Microsoft, every time I went to IBM and Microsoft, I met people that were every bit as smart as we were and totally on their game. So these are bright people who have a different perspective and who don't necessarily have the same taxonomy under their belt and the principles they've been led to, you know, the management principles they've assumed over time are no longer relevant. If you get that right, it's like, it just works great. I don't have any metaphors that can be repeated in a session like this. The other thing that's interesting about LPM is that for years we said, wait on that. Nobody gets it yet. You still got your SDLC milestones. They're worried about compliance. You got budget audits. You got financial audits. You got internal, external audits. You just don't get there. But what's happening now is people start to recognize how valuable it is to have a way to reason about strategy. And the reason that's so nuanced is it's all abstractions. There's not a line of code up there. They don't write any code. They're only words that express ideas. So as such, that's tougher. And you've probably seen that quote from Jeffrey Moore. It says, we just don't have a good dialogue for reasoning about strategy. We don't know who does it. We don't know what their titles are. And we don't know how to bring them together to resolve that. So the portfolio area has been there for us, you know, since day one. But it used to be, hey, there's some epics of some people. Now we're starting to flush it out to create a bit of a protocol, which is sequential. Can you do strategic themes? Probably. Do you have to stop and refigure out what your strategy is to do that? Maybe not, because it's implied. Okay, well, if it's not implied, you're going to have to do that. Okay, I've got strategic themes now. Can I now look at my epics and say they relate to a strategic theme or not? Sure. How do I create epics? You know, where do epics come from? Well, right. Why don't we sit down and do a SWOT matrix, and then we'll invert it and say, what would we do to further our strengths and either mitigate or ignore our weaknesses? Well, those are initiatives. Those initiatives are epics. So that thread of hope for consistency and guidance is thinking tools. We don't tell anybody what their strategy should be. Even you guys don't do that, right? You may have people in your company that do, but it isn't us. But to say, here's a thinking tool that said, have you considered this element of strategy? Have you looked at the portfolio context? What KPIs would we measure a value stream by? What's a value stream? Okay, you've got to get down that road and put those constructs in place. And I'm sure what you've discovered is that if you work with enterprises and they either don't get value streams or they think they do and do them badly, you're going to be in trouble because we don't have any way to reason about the flow of work without organizing it around each individual value stream.
Well, yeah, mapping projects as value streams is really key. What I think that I like the idea of going earlier is that it forces leadership to think big with their ideas, as opposed to oftentimes what I see at companies is they know how to get to the granular level and they focus on the granular level and they don't think big. They don't put the right wording around the big.
Granular, it means you get the what, not the why.
Right.
And then all of a sudden you're doing development work and two people are doing the same thing or three people think this is differently. And, what's it mean to remote enable a course? Oh, we put an article out. Well, did that change the course? No, it's the same slides. Okay, well, how are they going to do that exercise? Well, I hope they read the article. Well, you know, obviously we're clever than that. But communicating around those things is where the abstract becomes tangible. The challenge up there is it is all abstract. They're words.
Yeah.
They're epic. They're prioritized. So, they're WSJF. They have lightweight business cases, but none of it is code.
So if we can pull on that thread a little bit further in the sense of when you're talking to and having done a lot of work in the strategic area, when talking to clients, large clients, right, enterprise clients, when they want to go ahead and start to scale, let's just say their Scrum Pack practices are few and far between, pockets here and there. When they want to launch, right, and define an LPM, would you say that it's okay to start there? Or would you recommend?
I would. Years ago, I wouldn't, but now I would. And a number of reasons for that. It's different, but there's no unit testing and there's no DevOps up there. So the reality is it's different in a way that's probably tougher for us to relate, but this is their natural place to play, right? This is their domicile. They hang around with that stuff. And secondly, the bugaboo in all of this is excess multiplexing and too much WIP. Well, that doesn't just start at the team level. That starts by saying, you know, when we just did our big pivot, we took stuff off the radar. So our CEO is a lean thinking manager teacher, and he said, we're going to do this stuff now, and my ears are wide open to tell us what we're not going to do. Well, that's what you have to do as a lean thinking manager teacher, not you're going to do it all anyway because you have to. You have to recognize that some things you're not going to do. So if you want to have your capacity, if you want to have your demand match the capacity, well, you can't just, you know, flip a switch and change capacity. The only thing you can do is limit demand. So starting there is okay by me, so long as they're willing to listen. They'll spend a couple of days in Leading Safe. They get the taxonomy. They think about it. They go away and say, let's try this. That's great. But if they just walk in and your value streams and epics and strategic themes, it's just going to be Greek to them. It's going to be like having them come down and try to coach us on how to write a method in C#.
Yeah, and what presents to me as you're walking us through that, which I love, by the way, I'm a firm believer in starting at that level, even before, you know, all through the iterations of Safe we've implemented, but in the sense of you can use disruption as an ally in the leadership space. So getting the leadership engaged and eating their own dog food and not just, you know, command and control, I'm telling you to go change, it makes them empathetic to the organization of what they're asking their company to do. So I greatly appreciate that insight. I think we're coming up towards the end of our time. I know Troy had one more question that he wanted to put out there.
There's no 3-hour podcast, thankfully.
I know, and believe me, I would love to pick your brain for a long time, Dean, and I hope we can continue the conversation. But I do want to get a few more one or two more questions from the group, and then we'll go ahead and let everyone go back to being socially distant.
So okay. So, Dean, we did a podcast last year based on a Forbes article that was, I don't remember the gentleman who wrote the article, but if you remember.
We'll post it in the link when we release the show.
And it was a nice debate on the podcast, but I was basically making the argument that Forbes article, which was about how there was no customer centricity in Safe, that was the general.
I remember that article. Yeah. That's what happens if you look at the big picture and draw your judgments and you don't read anything.
That's what that basically, Dean, that was what I said in a nutshell.
Literally his entire argument.
Yes, I said this is the definition of Sedampa straw man argument, like, you know. Yeah. So but and then there was some recent at least 4 or 5 months ago.
Excuse me a second, Troy, but
yeah.
I remember that article well.
Yeah.
It's a lot harder to say that without 5.0. They have to look the other way now. They have to look at across the room and say, I don't see customer centricity and say, the customer was always there.
Yeah. So I agree with you because actually one of the things I did was internally at the company, I just circled everywhere where the customer is represented, but it doesn't say the word customer and it was like all over the map. Yep. So anyway, the point is, my second question is there was some presentation that was done, was it Department of Defense or maybe it was a government agency, and they were basically talking about was some negative thing about Safe and scaling frameworks in general. And I was just curious, Dean, you know, when you see these type of things in Forbes or that get some kind of publicity and get it spread around, you know, what is your take on that? Because a lot of times to me, it seems like people writing this, and I can't speak for everybody, but maybe either one, they've had a bad experience, which is obviously valid.
Can happen.
Or two, looked at a picture on a website. So I don't know.
I remember one of the, I won't say who, one of the thought leaders out there in the industry that says, I don't really know much about Safe or understand it, but I really don't like it. And that was his intro. Right. So here's how we respond to that. Number one, we need to be the adults on the Agile block because our customers and your customers take their work seriously. And they don't want to see me throwing tomatoes at any other thought leader. And if that thought leader throws tomatoes at us, it doesn't stick because the market doesn't want to do that. I put it in two categories. Some are just stupid and wrong because they don't like Safe for another reason. Many have significant financial motivations to not do Safe. Just a fact. Okay, that could be it. So the ones that are stupid, I just ignore. Now, in most of these, for example, let's just go back to that customer centricity discussion. Mm-hmm. That was stupid, and yet we fixed it, right?
Yeah.
So we are inspired by this, and whenever we find something that we go, that's kind of interesting, we fix it. And one of the traps we're in right now is in kind of this whole kind of DevOps thread. people look at the big picture and say, they release every PI, how slow is that? Crap. If you click on the article and read it, it doesn't say that at all, but that's all they got. They said, oh, look at that. Every 10 weeks, they're going to release something. Well, that's a place where we haven't helped ourselves because they can look at that, interpret that. So what we're thinking about now is how would we eliminate even that? Because one by one by one, we're able to say, that's a good point. We'll fix it. And we're now, we don't have five major releases. As you know, there was a 4.5, there was a 4.6, and you might not know there was a 2.5. So we're actually kind of the eighth or ninth release, and we can go pretty fast. So when we see things like saying, we don't see customers in SAFE, I'd argue with that. And they say, we don't see design thinking in SAFE, I go, that's a good point. Give me a year. So we kind of look at it as have at it. Please tell us the stuff you think that sucks so we can change that, because some of our customers might see it the same way.
You know, I've got a Scrum trainer friend that for years has just bagged SAFE, and he, due to the coronavirus, you know, everybody's quarantining, he's got all this spare time now on his hands. And so he took leading SAFE, and he was like, you know, there's something to this SAFE thing. And I remember when I got the text and I was like, thank you. Like, I listen, all frameworks have their pluses and but in the end, they're just frameworks, right? But it,
they are.
The people that spend the time to like go through the material, I was one of them. When I went three and a half, four years ago, when I first took my SPC class, right? I was like, this is stupid. I'm not going to enjoy this. This is a waste of my time. Why am I having to do this for my clients? And now I've spent 3 years launching trains, and I totally get it. Like, it's, you can't spend time with the material and not truly see there's some value in it.
Yeah,
I truly believe it.
But you got to, you know, put your fixed mindset away and click and read. And if you're not economically motivated to do that, you're pretty unlikely to do it. I mean, the reality is we've really seen success in the market. The case study I put up today, you know, 80% improvement in basically customer net promoter score. This stuff really works. So it works, and consequently it's scaled throughout the industry. Well, that means that we're disrupting lots of things, other people's opinions, other people's methods. And, you know, leaders take arrows in their back, and I don't mind. I've been leading my career. I got holes all over me, but still having fun. And as long as those case studies say our employee engagement went up 25 basis points when we adopted SAFE, I'm good to go. So sling away. Give me your best shot.
We've got an
organization with 10,000 employees whose employee engagement just went up by 25 basic points.
And the previous podcast we did, Dean, if we land this, and I love where we got to it at the, you know, we're wrapping up, coming toward the end of our time, is you said something, and I hope you don't mind me quoting you don't make apologies for anything. And I loved the transparency of what you just walked us through, that you live, eat, and breathe the dog food that you're serving, right? Like, you eat your own dog food as an organization, and you welcome the feedback, right? Good and bad. It's all data. That is all important. So I really appreciate you being transparent and, you know, not apologizing for what you're putting out in the universe. And it's the one constant, what is the one constant thing with every framework is people. The frameworks don't fail, right? So it's double clicking, getting more curious, getting more knowledge and practicing. If you can't practice this stuff, you can't just read about it and not, you have to be able to practice it and put it into practice. So I want to thank everyone for their time, especially Dean for literally, we have hours we could banter on and on and on. You have three very enthusiastic and four very enthusiastic people about not only Agile, but working within the Scaled Agile framework. So thank you, Dean. I want to give you an opportunity.
Thanks to you guys. I appreciate not just the podcast, but you realize that you're the people that do the heavy lifting in the industry. We don't transform enterprises. We create a framework and courseware that allows you to. So as far as I'm concerned, you are the pointy end of the stick. You know, I started this because I like being on an Agile team better than not being on one. That's 20 years later, still true.
Good point. Absolutely. Dean. Thank you, Dean. Absolutely. I really appreciate it. So, Dean, I wanted to give you an opportunity if you had anything you wanted to plug or put out into the ether. We have quite a few listeners that always appreciate anything that, our thought leaders are doing.
Yeah, so the European Summit is going virtual. Well, guess what? That opens up 3 days of content to everyone, not just the folks in Europe. So go to the website, log in there. It's certainly, I think, priced reasonably, and we'd really like to get people there. We've got, I think, 40 tech talks. I mean, I'm sure you guys have been to some. This is where our new stuff is always shown. We did have to eliminate the workshops because those were really our R&D, you know, and R&D in front of live ammunition. But get online, join us, spend a day, part of a day, or 2 days or so, and see the latest stuff that we've got to offer because we're always evolving safe. And we've got probably 35 people smarter than me all talking about their experiences and some ideas that they would like to help the community move forward with.
Awesome.
So my only ad, the safe is free, so I can't do that. Attend the summit. We'll make a few bucks on that.
Perfect.
Thank you, Dean.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Dean. I just want to, you know, give a shout out to Dean again, as well as I want to thank Chris and Troy for being my co-hosts this evening. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a review or rating, comments on iTunes, Spotify, whatever platform you're using. We're probably there. You can also join us on the Coalition and our Discord site at agileuprising.com. And until next time. So again, Dean, thanks. Thanks. Chris. And thanks, Troy. Everyone stay safe and wash your hands.
Thank you. And let me know when you're live. I'll blog it.
Will do.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
See you. Thanks, Dean.
Bye.
Take care.
Bye.